I have here a New Yorker cartoon. Old woman coming up to a police officer and saying, pointing and saying, "Officer, everything in the world is bothering me." And this is part of why we come to practice. This is part of what brings us to Zen. That's kind of the backside. The front side is expressed here by Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is the historical Buddha, the guy who 2,500 years ago started this tradition that we are continuing here today. And in a text called the Dhammapada, which is a very succinct series of verses out of the Pali canon, which are the Pali is a language, it's a dialect of Sanskrit, and it's the language in which the original teachings of the Buddha were written down in, and it was probably also what he spoke. This is from a text called the Dhammapada, which is a really short summary of all the essence of the Buddha's path. And if you haven't read it, I encourage you to pick it up and read it. It's brief and really enjoyable. There are many good translations, and I would recommend any of them except one by a guy named Byrom, B-Y-R-O-M. Avoid that one. But the line that I wanted to read you today was, the Buddha said, "It is not what others do and do not do that is my concern. It is what I do and do not do that is my concern." This is the essence of this practice. This is the alternative we have to going up and saying, "Officer, everything in the world is bothering me." This is actually very empowering. This is the good news, that it actually isn't about what anybody else does. It isn't about what is going wrong in the world. It isn't about things not being the way we might wish. It's about what we do and do not do in response to the world, in response to the difficult people, to the difficult situations, in response to the arising of our own grasping aversion and the stories and certainty that we grab onto, which is the essence of delusion. It's about how we relate to those things. It's about what we do and do not do when those things arise. And this is part of so what we do not do, or what we start to have the option of not doing as a result of this sitting practice that we do, we start to have the option of, when anger arises, we have an option other than acting angrily. And it doesn't mean, this practice does not mean that anger doesn't arise. Anger always arises. We never purge ourselves of anger any more than we purge ourselves of our humanity. That's part of what it means to be the beings we are. Anger arises. Ordinarily, without practice, we then act angrily, speak angrily in the world. We cause harm to ourselves, to those around us. We act unskillfully in ways that worsen the situations, that feed into our own anger, that create anger and suffering in other people. And in Buddhism, it's said that there isn't a Buddhism, there's no model of kind of cosmic or divine punishment, but there is a model of suffering. And so we don't get punished for acting angrily. Acting angrily actually is the self created suffering, of it is the karma, the experience of being all caught up and bound up in our anger is itself the result, is itself in a way the judging, the judgment of anger and self-judging. And so when we go on automatic pilot and act those things out, we are creating suffering in ourselves, creating suffering in each other. But with practice, we also have the option of not doing that. When anger arises, when grasping arises, when fear, lust, anxiety, any of these things arise, we have the option of recognizing them as having arisen, returning ourselves to our intention, to our intention to be the person we mean to be, to act with skillfulness, to act usefully, relevantly to the situation, to cause no harm to the best of our ability, to act with kindness, generosity, and compassion. And when we have this moment of space between the arising of our reactivity and the acting out of our reactivity, we can then start to see how we want to respond. We start to have a moment of choice to be the person we mean to be. Zen Buddhism is part of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which is it's kind of like, in a way, the Protestantism of Buddhism, but only in the sense that it's a kind of later additional development, and it doesn't stand in opposition to the other kind of Buddhism, which is called Theravada Buddhism. But it has some additional perspectives, and one of those additional perspectives that we return to in the practice of Mahayana Buddhism is our vow, which we'll be making at the end of the night tonight, to save all beings throughout space and time, to be of service to all beings everywhere. And so when we start to have this moment of choice, where we are start to be aware of what we do and do not do, we return to our intention, to our aspiration, to save and serve all beings. There's another pair of New Yorker cartoons I have here, which are actually by two different authors, but both of them are people browsing in the bookstore. And in this one, in one of them, they're browsing in the self-improvement section, which is right next to the self-involvement section. And in this other one, the guy is yet again in the self-improvement section, but this is a bigger, better bookstore. You know, maybe it's like Borders or something like that. So they have a self-improvement section, a self-empowerment section, and a self-aggrandizement section. So this practice of Buddhism, this practice of Zazen, can easily get subverted, twisted into self-aggrandizement, self-involvement. It actually isn't even self-improvement, but that's the topic for another Dharma talk. And in an important way, what we do here in the cushion, what we do here on the cushion, what we do in the Zendo, you know, coming together each week to sit, or this is the remedial class. This isn't something that we do because we are special. This isn't something that actually makes us better. This is something that enables us to engage the world more naturally, more skillfully. And so it's important to approach our own spiritual practice with the spirit of humility, and not to make Zazen into Zen meditation or your meditation practice into something precious and self-aggrandizing, or to make too much out of the practice, to make it into a kind of fetish object, the stillness of Zazen. And in an important way, this practice of Zazen is really substantial way, a lot like exercise, like physical exercise. And it is just a simple fact of the matter that a life that includes some exercise on some kind of a regular basis is going to be healthier and just generally feel better to you over the long run. But there's nothing to... And the same is true of Zazen. It isn't that you have to devote your entire life to sitting on the cushion. And it isn't that you're trying to sit on the cushion to have some great experience. You know, just as any given, you know, morning on the treadmill, like what are you accomplishing? You're just, I mean, what would it mean to win? And yet, even though it wouldn't actually make any sense to think like that, it's worth spending some time on the treadmill. And that isn't a major paradox. And in the same way, once we spend a little time with this practice, and just like exercise, the first time you do it or the first little while you do it, you're like, oh my God, I so did not enjoy that at all. And the same is true of practice. But when we do it, even when we do it and we're not enjoying it, right? Even when you're not enjoying your workout, it's still worth doing, right? That doesn't mean you're bad at working out. It doesn't mean you're a bad person or a bad workouter, any more than sitting down with your own mind and encountering your mind doing its thing on going off and spinning its stories and getting lost. And none of that means that you are a bad Zen person or that your Zazen is bad. But so doing a little bit of working out, doing a certain amount of Zazen in your life enables your entire life to perhaps go more spaciously. It gives you more flexibility to encounter your life. It doesn't make, I was going to say smoothly, but it doesn't actually make your life smooth. But what it enables you to do is encounter the inevitable bumpiness with less pain and grief and angst. And it lets you encounter pain and grief and angst with less pain and grief and angst. You know, in the same way that, you know, a little bit of exercise, then when you're late for the bus and you have to run half a block to catch up with it, you know, that you can, if you've been exercising a little bit regularly, that is perhaps less incapacitating, less excruciating. Or if the elevator is out and you have to walk up six flights of stairs to your doctor's office or something, you know, rather than having to wheeze and heave once you get up the stairs and you know, lie down on the floor and moan for a little while before you get back up. You know, if you've spent a little time on the treadmill, then you can go, okay, I'm going to walk up these stairs. And you feel it in your legs, and maybe you're a little bit sore, but you're able to go on about your business. And the same with Zazen. And there's another way in which Zazen, this engaging in this practice, is, and also engaging in the practice of that's kind of expressed in, it's expressed liturgically in the gatha of atonement, the chant of atonement that we did at the beginning of the night tonight, and in the chant that we'll do at the end of the night, the Bodhisattva's vows to save all beings. So we atone for the harm we have caused. We acknowledge, yes, I am here in this moment. I am at one with this moment, not in any kind of mystical sense, but in the, yes, this is my suffering self. This is me taking responsibility. This is me acknowledging that rather than saying, officer, everything in the world is bothering me, I'm going to now attend to what I do and do not do. I said do. So we acknowledge where we are, we atone, and then we aspire to where we are aiming to be, to save and serve all beings, to cause less and less harm in the world. And then we fall short, always, again and again and again. And then we atone, aspire, fall short. Atone, aspire, fall short. This is the practice. This is the life of Zen. And there's no moment in that when you also win. Another cartoon here. A couple watching TV in their living room. It says, this week on The Amazing Race to Enlightenment, can Jim and Susie achieve right mindfulness? And will Barb and Candy be eliminated for relentless clinging to the self? No! That isn't the way we roll here in the Dharma. It's just this. Just this. Zen master Dogen, who is a 13th century Zen master, the founder of one of our lineages, the Japanese tradition of Soto Zen, he says, if you cannot find the truth right where you are, where else do you expect to find it? Another way of saying that is, don't imagine it somewhere else. Whatever it is, whatever you imagine, enlightenment, freedom, choicefully present, right mindfulness, non-clinging to the self, whatever you imagine that is, don't imagine it somewhere else. All of that is available right here. And it really is profoundly unspecial. And in an instrumentalist kind of way, from the view that Zazen actually, that we actually are doing something, we are cultivating a skill that then is useful elsewhere, which is one view. And that's a little bit what I've been talking about so far. The other view is the practice from the absolute, in which we are appreciating this moment in its full perfection regardless. This is a topic for a different talk, so I'm talking from the instrumentalist side, the view that Zazen does something in the service of something. And this is one side. You come to a second Dharma talk, you'll hear me talk about the other side. And one of the beauties of the, one of the great gifts of Dharma practice, and Zen especially, is that it helps us get over this deeply suffering-causing habit of always needing to choose this or this, one side or the other, the absolute or the instrumental, form or emptiness, and we are able to appreciate them both. But from the instrumentalist side, part of what we are doing in Zazen, so a thought arises in Zazen, and our mind moves away. Doesn't matter what this thought is, and it doesn't matter whether it's grasping, aversion, or or a story we're telling ourselves. It doesn't matter whether it is an emotional feeling like an anxiety, a verbal feeling like a shopping list, or even actually a somatic thing, a thing in our body like pain in our knee. And so whatever captures our attention, wherever our mind moves on to, for some amount of time our mind is there. And then at some point, after a minute, 24 minutes, a day, 17 years, we notice, oh, I've been really caught up in that thing over there. And then when we notice, we bring our attention back to right here, where it's not, where we don't imagine it's somewhere else. We bring it back to right here, back to our breath, back to our butt on the cushion, back to just sitting, or back to counting the breath. And so we start here, mind moves away, we notice, and we come back. Gradually, with practice, this interval between when we move away and when we notice, oh, I've moved away, oh, this thought has arisen, oh, I've fallen into some kind of automatic pilot, gradually lessens, shrinks. And sometimes, if you stick with practice long enough, you can actually see the thing arising and not go anywhere, which is when the event and the awareness of the event are simultaneous. But even this simultaneous, you still don't win the amazing race to enlightenment. Because in the next moment, you're going to get caught. Boy, I'm really doing this so well. Boy, I just noticed that coming right up. All right. Yeah. So sometimes it's long, sometimes it's short. And you can only do what you can do when you can do it. You can only be aware of what you're aware of when you become aware of it. You can't be aware of what you're not aware of, and you can't do it before you can do it. And so whenever we so much want to start in, we have such conditioning to start in with a tirade of, boy, I'm so horrible because I didn't notice that I've been acting angrily, that I didn't really mean to. I was so frustrated by the thing, and I've been acting angry, and it's been going on for like 3 days. And then we start in about how awful those 3 days are. But actually, hallelujah, because you noticed that. You now have the awareness. And right now, you can do what you can do. You can bring your attention back to this moment. You can take responsibility. You can make amends. You can apologize. You can change your behavior. You can atone. And you can aspire again to be the person you mean to be, to walk the bodhisattva path, to walk the Buddha way. And then you get caught in another thing, and you notice. But it's always this, and it doesn't actually matter. It really, really doesn't matter whether it's been 3 days, 17 years, or 4 milliseconds between when you started this thing and when you noticed it. The practice is always the same. So this is an empowering practice, being not concerned what others do and do not do, and being concerned with what I do and do not do. This is profoundly empowering. This is universally applicable. It's applicable in every context of our life, because it isn't dependent circumstantially on anybody else doing their thing, or not doing their thing, or being a pain in our butt, or helping us out. It's not dependent on that. And it's not also dependent on circumstances. And this is what, in the piece that we read today, this is what Tori Zenji says when he says it's, even though someone may speak ill of us or treat us bitterly. Which is to say that even though the external circumstance can be whatever we imagine the worst external circumstance could be, still, Tori Zenji says, it's best to bow down, to notice that this is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. So even though when we go to the police officer and say, "Officer, that guy is speaking ill of me and treating us bitterly." So when that happens, we know that that is us pointing outward, saying the problem is out there. And that is profoundly disempowering. There's nothing you can do if the problem is out there. There's an African proverb that says, whenever you point a finger at somebody, there's always three fingers pointing back at you. That guy is really making my life really hard. Don't! And in her introduction tonight, I overheard Kate give a really great phrase to describe what happens. She said, the moment in which we notice that our mind is a really rich moment, and the way that we habitually respond to things shows itself to us in our zazen. Whenever our mind does its thing, that's an opportunity to see our mind doing its thing, to really become familiar with, oh, that is that thing my mind does. And to get the opportunity to be undeceived by it, to be familiar with it so that you're able to recognize it and respond with flexibility, kindness, and compassion in the off-the-cushion context. And the more that that happens while we're sitting on our cushion in a really important way, we're better. The better. That's great. So, if you've read, you know, three books about Zen, you've encountered or even if you've come to our orientation and listened to us talk about Zen for half an hour, you hear that some version of something about the perfection of the moment. We are all our own original enlightenment. When we bow to the Buddha, we're not bowing to anything outside ourselves. We're bowing to our own Buddha nature. Buddha nature, the awakened nature of all beings. The Buddha, in a mythological kind of way, in the sense of, he probably didn't actually say this, but it is said in the Zen tradition that upon his enlightenment, the Buddha said, "I and all beings simultaneously attain the way." I and all beings simultaneously are enlightened. And Master Dogen, who I talked about before, his great driving question was, well, if we're all already enlightened, why do we have to practice? And we bring some version of that question too. This was what drove his spiritual investigation. But there's other other forms this question can take. Less dramatic forms, like, why should I sit? Why do I have to sit? How much should I sit? Should I sit every day? 4 hours. And when you find yourself in any of these things, it's really helpful to shift it from being precious and special and some kind of epic endeavor that you're engaged in, to just returning to the awareness that it's like spending some time on the elliptical trainer. Or like brushing your teeth. God, if we're all inherently enlightened, why do I have to brush my teeth? I mean, you don't. You may find that you get cavities and your teeth hurt and maybe fall out, and then you have difficulty chewing your food, and then there's some more suffering, and that's fine too. But, you know, it's avoidable, and you could try brushing your teeth. And Zazen is kind of like that. But we want it to be something else. We're so sure that it's definitely something else. One last cartoon. A couple of guys sitting on zafus and zabutons in front of the Buddha, yet apparently having a conversation. One guy's saying, I read so much about it beforehand that I couldn't help being disappointed when I actually became enlightened. The thing that we realize is that it's just this. And you hear it now and you're like, yeah, just this. Okay, I got it. Yeah, just this. Okay. And yet, there will come a time, if you stick with this path, and you'll be like, oh my God, it's just this. Or when we chant the Heart Sutra, a very famous sutra, which is in pretty much every Zen sangha in the universe, maybe other than this one, whenever there's a Zen liturgy, they chant the Heart Sutra. I don't personally think that the Heart Sutra needs to be chanted quite that much, but it is something we chant occasionally. And it has the very, very incomprehensible and obscure line, form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness exactly form. And you're like, oh my God, I have no idea what that means. That is totally inscrutable. That is so inscrutable that I think it's meaningless. And yet, there's a experience when, you know, you stick with this long enough and you'll be like, oh, form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness exactly form. And it is profoundly banal. So, spend some time on the elliptical trainer. Brush your teeth. Sit a certain amount of zazen. I'll wrap it up there. And I want to open up the floor to comments, observations, questions, complaints. There's all kinds of games that we can play for ourselves, with ourselves. All kinds of little prizes we can award ourselves. And up to a certain point, those can be motivating. And they can also get turned around and become an additional source of suffering. We can make our spiritual practice an additional stick to beat ourselves with, an additional metric to judge ourselves by and find ourselves unworthy. And when that happens, it's perhaps worthwhile to investigate, to notice this game that you're playing, and to see that it actually is extra. It is an unnecessary level of suffering that you're bringing upon yourself. But if that's not, but you don't have to worry about it. You can just notice. You can just notice, oh, that's my mind doing that thing. I used to, so if we make a super big deal out of each time we sit, I did my spiritual practice today, I am a good Zen student, then we are setting ourselves up for a lot of grief when whatever circumstance comes to be, and we, for any of a variety of reasons, don't end up doing that spiritual practice that we intended to do, doing some zazen, and then we fall into, oh, I'm so horrible, I'm such a bad Zen student, I just can't possibly, and then that's a lot of grief. And just to notice, those are two sides of the same thing. I'm a good Zen student, I'm a bad Zen student. Neither one of those games is actually really necessary. Thank you for that observation. So what if being present in the moment itself is causing suffering? And what was the second half?
If we pursue the thought that is conscious
of mind,
that's a relief
from death. And then I guess it's a question about escaping, and it's true that sometimes we want to just watch some TV. Sometimes we want to, check out in some way or other, or do some kind of, read a book, get caught up in those things as a way of being away from getting a little breather from how painful it is to be in our lives right now as they are. And that's okay. That is totally okay. But the thing is that there will come a time when there is some kind of suffering, some kind of pain that you actually can't escape from. And if we have spent our entire life always escaping and avoiding from the pain that we find we can temporarily escape and avoid from, then when we find ourselves confronting something we can't get any escape from, any space from, any solace, and minimally that will be old age, sickness, death, loss, change, all of those things. And this is why we do the five remembrances as part of even our short liturgy, to remind us that however awesome your life is right now, you're still going to get sick, grow old, and die. Maybe you can avoid growing old, but the only way to do that is by getting sick and dying. And even if theoretically, you could personally avoid those things, still people around you are going to get sick, grow old, and die. Still, there is suffering. And so it's really, really important to spend some of our time practicing this other thing, practicing this other way of interacting with the pain-causing stuff, by being concerned with what we do and do not do in this moment. You don't have to do it all the time. And that's the way that Zen practice can become a kind of fetish. It can become a kind of obsession. It can become a way of... It can actually become a way of escaping by really rigidly making her practice about always being here. And we're pushing away. We're suppressing. We're pushing down large swaths of the universe of ourselves, of human experience. And that's not what it's about. But some amount of your life you should spend practicing this other thing so that you have this skill to draw upon. And once you start to trust this skill, once you have to start to trust your ability to be with any moment, even moments filled with pain, then that leads to a really kind of deep trust. And a kind of peace, solace, refuge that is indestructible. It is not dependent on external circumstances. And so, definitely, life includes watching television. Life includes glass of wine, bottle of beer. Life includes getting lost in a good book. And to make sure life also includes showing up to this moment as it is a path that will serve you very well throughout your life. Thank you for that question. It's a really good point.
It's been my experience that something interesting happens over time. Just you said we usually have the movements that we play for ourselves or escape when we go to the section on self, the grand doctrine or whatever form that takes for us. Sometimes it's self-dimension, sometimes it's we tell ourselves lots of stories, we apply ourselves earnestly, we listen to the talks and pick up useful things to apply. And there's a way in which, over a long period of time, it's like, in my experience, that all that doesn't matter, almost. In essence, I really love the analogy of brushing teeth or going to the gym. You know, the message is just kind of just do it. And as maybe as we're exercising on the treadmill, this little self that gets aggrandized or that we that plays the games on itself or whatever, it's almost like you know, precepts that thing a couple weeks ago, talking about this mini, you know, kind of in our head. It's like this little gerbil on its own treadmill. And eventually, you know, all the strategies we have for improving ourselves or getting enlightened or not caring about enlightenment or whatever, you know, that gerbil just kind of like exhausts itself and collapses. And that's where things can go. There is, so in my experience, there's this element of saying it's just no way. We can tell ourselves lots of stories about what it is and what it's achieving, but in the end, just do it.
Right. So that, just do it is. In an important way. It really is a very important kind of Zen slogan. On the other hand, just do it is not. And there's a way that just do it can become a source of suffering. Just white knuckle it, Zen it. And that is not this practice. Just do it. Just show up. Just be here.
And yet, isn't it perhaps true that
Right, and that's fine too. That's right.
You can't.
That's right. Whatever state that we attain, from maybe whenever we get into the runner's high of zazen, right? And then it gets easy and lovely, and the gerbil has collapsed, and we're no longer fighting this moment. That's great. And more power to you, but the gerbil is gonna get some rest. Eat a power bar. Psych himself back up and get back on that wheel of samsara. And so to be able to receive both of those equally. Gerbil on the wheel, gerbil collapsed off the wheel, to show up to that life as it is. A lot of good stuff there, Jeff. Thank you. Can you speak up a little bit?
Along the lines of what is the exercise component of zazen, thinking lately that it's a practice of spending time attempting to be open to whatever happens, and therefore you're never gaining or losing anything because you're just simply being open to 25 minutes of ranting or 25 minutes of listening to the birds or 25 minutes of noticing the bugs go across in front of you. And maybe the exercise component of it, the part that you hope that maybe you'll get better at, is being able to stay open longer and longer.
Maybe. But maybe not. You might never be any more open than you are today. This might be it for you, buddy. And so, in an important way, you're kind of pointing to with what you were saying before about just being open to 25 minutes of ranting, just being open to 25 minutes of bugs on your nose, but whatever. You're talking about you're a little bit coming in the side of the absolute practice of zazen, which is what the practice of shikantaza is. And shikantaza, or just sitting, is a practice that we start after perhaps some number of years of doing this instrumental practice of returning to the breath or counting the breath, of building that as a foundation. But then when we go into the absolute practice of shikantaza, we actually need to abandon all of our instrumentalist hopes. We need to because then we are subverting our shikantaza into a kind of striving, into trying to get into a better, more open way of being, as opposed to actually being open to this not open way of being. So, excellent points all around, and what James is really skillfully pointing to is that the way to, maybe you will be more open more easily more of the time later, but the way to that is exactly what James is saying, is of being open to this moment as it is, this experience as it is. And when we do that, then maybe that other stuff comes. But we have to leave it in the category of maybe. Or that becomes a standard by which we can judge ourselves to have failed. So, great stuff. Thank you. One more question, perhaps? Comment? No? Steve?
In exercise and brushing teeth, and at the gym, for example, you even pause the headphones and get lost in the music.
That's right. So that's the place where the analogy breaks down a little bit. Listening to music at the gym is not contrary. It does not interfere with the fundamental practice of being at the gym, which is moving your body, which is exercising. Getting lost in music on the headphones, listening to your headphones, it is something that is contrary to the activity of cultivating the skill of showing up. Although there is a way to practice even just listening, to train ourselves in that skill, we need to practice our zazen without listening on our headphones. But there are things that are like the headphones at the gym with regard to zazen, such as moving. This is why we do walking meditation, is to emphasize that zazen actually doesn't have to do with whether your body is still or moving. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you're sitting or lying down. It doesn't have anything to do whether you're sitting cross-legged or in a chair. Those things are kind of the things that are like headphones at the gym. You can still do the fundamental essence, part of the activity, in motion, in a chair, lying down, in a hospital bed. Thank you. So let's wrap it up there, and we will conclude with the four Bodhisattva vows.